Want to try a free sample of berry pie?
Oh, yeah, I do. Wait, time to consult the online experts.
One bite will destroy your body.
Stop it! Stop it!
They don't know your body. Only you do. Cygnos pairs AI with a biosensor so you can track your body's unique responses to food, movement, and more in real time, helping you achieve your health goals. Get $10 off select plans at Cygnos.com. Cygnos.com with code SPARK. Cygnos.
I was having lunch in a restaurant in Cali, Colombia. And 10 hitmen got to where I was, and it was a disaster. There were 6 people dead. I decided to call my wife and say like goodbye to her because, you know, I don't know, something. And I pick up my cell phone, I call her. I talk to her, tell her that I love her and protect my kid. I don't know why I say that. And when I finished the call, immediately the guys got up and then 2 of those guys start shooting at us. And unfortunately for me, I tried to, you know, get up. That saved my life because I would have been hit in my face. So and you know, the inertia of the shots threw me back. So I fell in another table. That table comes on top of me, and unfortunately one of my friends got hit here, and he immediately, you know, all the blood was by my side, and then I lay down and I was like, you know, making that I was dead. But I was seeing this guy move from here, from there, and there were seconds, but for me it was like an hour, you know, this guy. And when the guy decided to go, you know, I called for help.
Right, so today we have got a exclusive interview with William, whose book we have just brought out. It's The Son of the Cali Cartel, and we're going to be getting into a hell of a lot of detail about that shortly. But before I begin, you know, many of you are familiar with William's story if you've watched Narcos, which was a misrepresentation of the actual truth, and we're going to get to that as well. But this is a massive story because the Cali Cartel, at the peak, they took over from Escobar, and they were moving tens of billions in cocaine worldwide. It did become the biggest distribution cartel in the world. And many of you are familiar with the 4 heads of the Cali Cartel. So you've got Chepe, Pacho, and then you've got Miguel, which is William's dad, and then you've got Gilberto, his brother, the chess player. So only Miguel is the surviving one. Sadly, Gilberto died earlier. It was this year, wasn't it, that he died?
Yeah, he died the 1st of June of this year.
1st of June this year, okay. So William was the acting head of the cartel when the surviving bosses went to jail. So can you imagine running a cartel that was shipping that much product and was worth, you know, revenue in the tens of billions a year? So the story is going to be absolutely breathtaking. But a huge thank you for coming on, William.
No, Sean, thank you for inviting me. You know, it's a pleasure, and thank you so much for believing in my book and how we can, you know, make people interested in that and knowing this story, because I believe this kind of story has to be told so they don't repeat this, you know, because that's the problem. No, my story is a little bit more critical. I don't glorify like, you know, Netflix does. I try to tell the truth of the things that happen in our family and in this organization.
All right. And before we get to how this all began, then, there is a story at the beginning of the book where there's an assassination attempt on your life. And for people interested in the book, link will be in the description box below this video, as will links for Reese Dry, who is managing William. So anyone wants to coordinate anything with William, go down in the description box and check out Rhys Dry's email and links. So could you set up the scene for what happened that day of the assassination attempt?
Yeah, it happened in 96. It was May of 96. We was having some problems with another cartel, the North Valley cartel. So I was, you know, I was having lunch in a restaurant in Cali, Colombia. And 10 hitmen got to where I was, and it was a disaster. There were 6 people dead, and I was the only one who survived this attempt in my life. I received 8 bullets in my body, and only God changed me, because he was the one who protected me and gave me a second chance to change my life. It was a very critical moment in this story for me, because, you know, I lost a lot of people that I care about. I lost 2 of my greatest friends, and I lost some people and my bodyguards that were close to me. And it changed my life, forever, because, you know, sometimes you believe you're untouchable, and in situations like this, wakes you up of that trance that I was, because I believe I could do anything and I was invincible. And God taught me that day that he was the only power and changed my life. No, it's not easy surviving that. And psychologically way, it was very difficult for me because, you know, like I said, wounds in your body heal, but those things are there forever. And all those memories will stay there, and it really changed my life, because it taught me a lesson, but it was not so simple, John, because, you know, I was not, you were not my boss or my partner or my father, so I had some responsibility, and I had to continue try to help them to run this organization, in the part of the political corruption, and try to, try to fight a war that was lost at the moment that we started, because when you fight against the Americans, it's difficult because in the end you have to make a bargain with them or they'll finish you off. And that's what happened. My father and uncle decided to go there are difficult types of war, and we went to the United States, like a legal war, and in the end we want to lose. So that's what I say. We began that confrontation with them, and in the end we were going to lose because they have the power and they destroyed us in the end.
All right. So on this day then of the assassination, can you remember how that day started for you? Were you with your family?
Yeah, it was, this started the day after, because, those guys hit on 2 of our guys who ran our power, in the street. And I don't know why I believe that there was like a normal thing that happened to one of those guys that worked with us. But I should have been, alert. And that day I wake up and I was going to go to a nearby town of Cali. It's called Buga, because there's like a saint there I was devoted to. And I was having, breakfast, and my friend that I was going to go with him to that city came to my house. And then my aunt called me. I used to run the soccer team of my family. We had a soccer team called America Cali. And we were doing a big business with a player we were selling to Portugal. So she told me that she needed me in the office. So I decided not to go to visit the saint. And then I went to, the office of the America of Cali, and I did the deal. And then I decided that it was time to go to lunch. And then I invited them to a Brazilian restaurant. And that's when this unfortunately situation happened.
Who were the people you had invited to lunch, and what were your relationships with them?
One was my friend, a close friend of mine that I was, you know, he was my buddy when we were 15 years old. And the other one was a guy who worked with me, but he was like a friend too, because he always was with me flying to Bogota and helping me with my business. And one of our top men, they used to run our guys in the street, you know, and I invited him to lunch. There was my cousin too. He was going to go, but unfortunately in those that he was calling, he didn't go. And then we went to that restaurant to find some of them to find their death.
So when you go to lunch like that, because of the business you were in back then, what security precautions are in place?
But you know, that's the main thing of this story, because you know, I believe I was untouchable. I believe nobody could to do nothing, because I was Miguel Rodriguez's son. I didn't have precaution at those moments. I only went with two guys. There were my bodyguards and the other guy that I told you, Nicole was his name, my friend. So I should have known, and being surrounded for 10 or 15 guys, but that day I gave the opportunity, and that's why I lost.
Okay, and you said this was a hit by the North Valley Cartel. Can you explain then to people who are or who were the North Valley Cartel and why you guys were in a war with them?
Because this is cyclical, no? First were Escobar. The guy, the main guy, we helped them destroy him. And then we became the number one. And then this business is stupid for me, because when a guy is up there, you want to take him down. And when you take him down, you're going to get the heat. So there's something that I don't understand. No, you should have an umbrella, and the umbrella will help you, you know, survive. But these guys, everybody wants to be number one. So these guys started, you know, like making up stories about us. My father and uncle were in jail. Chepe was in jail. And we didn't have the same power, because you start losing, no? Because you start, you know, we start retiring from the drug business. And you start to lose money, power. And these guys were, you know, getting in the place that we were. They were now the new drug lords. And we got in for some, you know, people talking things that were not true, and something that Chepe did to one of those guys. So it was like, you know, they started like making up stories to try to get in a conflict with us. And I had to go to a lot of meetings, you know, to try to clarify, you know, some stuff they were saying. And that's when my life became a hell, because I always was called for those guys, and I have to go, no, this is not this is not that, you know. But I believe when you say the truth, you always will survive and get out. But in the end, this is a very dangerous business, and in the end, if you don't be aware, you're gonna be hit, or you're gonna lose your everything.
Okay, so how far into the meal were you when these guys struck?
No, I was finished. I was asking for the check. You know, something happened, or something crazy happened, you know. And I decided to call my wife and say like goodbye to her, because, you know, I don't know, something. And I pick up my cell phone, I call her. I talk to her, tell her that I love her and protect my kid. I don't know why I say that. And When I finished the call, immediately the guys got up, and then two of those guys start shooting at us. And unfortunately for me, I tried to, you know, get up. That saved my life, because I would have been hit in my face. So I got hit here, and down. And so I don't know. It was fate. No, I don't know. Nobody. It's very difficult to survive. One shot, you know. Now I got hit 8 times, so it was a miracle.
Do you remember how the assassins were dressed?
Yeah, the guy who hit me, and that's what that image will be for life in my head. He had like jeans, blue jeans, and he had like a blue shoes. And when I fell down, because I got up, and you know, the inertia of the shots threw me back, so I fell. And another table, that table comes on top of me. And unfortunately, one of my friends got hit here. And he immediately, you know, all the blood was by my side. And then I lay down and I was like, you know, making and I was dead. But I was seeing this guy move from here, from there. And it was, there was, you know, there were seconds, but for me, it was like an hour, you know, this guy. And when the guy decided to go, you know, I called for help. I tried to get up, but one bullet broke my knee and I couldn't get up. If I didn't broke my knee, I would have gotten up, because I don't know. You know, I didn't understand, because when I fell down, the first thing when you are in those situations, that's the way you think. No, the first thing you think is in God. And the first word I say, God, save me, my little kid. This is not fair. That's what I said in my mind. And I tell you, when I finished to say that, I didn't know why I felt so calm. I don't know if my blood was coming out or not, but I felt calm. And I know in that moment, I was not going to die.
Had you ever been shot before, William, or was that the first time?
No, it was the first time.
Okay. And when the bullets come in you, did your adrenaline just go so high? And the pain comes later, or did the pain come right away?
No, you didn't feel pain. You know, I felt like something was in my stomach, stuck in my stomach. But one day I met a guy who was a top leader of the M19, he surrendered himself, one of the top guerrillas groups. And he was a friend of mine, you know, and the guy was shot too. So the guy was so crazy, and he told me, right, William, that when you're dying, that's cool, because you start going in that trance that you are in, you know, because, you know, blood is coming out and then you're relaxed and that's it. I believe that was the way I was calm, because the blood was coming out. I lost almost half of the blood in my body.
When you made the call home before the shooting commenced and you said goodbye, do you think that subconsciously you had picked up on some kind of danger?
Maybe. I don't know why I did that. You know, like I was saying goodbye to my wife. Yeah, so it's crazy, you know, because I believe that day was my day. I think I should have died that day. I don't know why God decided to save me, because that day I was going to die. Because, you know, nobody survives something like that. God is not there for you.
So did you say that there were three other people with you and they died?
Yeah, we were sitting three. And me, four. And downstairs were two guys that were killed with silencer. And the other three guys were my two buddies and my bodyguard were killed.
And what about the assassins? Did they, any of them get killed, or did they manage to escape?
No, because remember that day I gave them the chance. I never would give chance to them, because from that day on, I always were protected by a lot of people around me, because that's we call it in Spanish la hora del bobo, like the hour of the dumb. Everybody has in a moment in their life, and that was mine. I gave the chance, and that's why they got to me.
All right, so you're on the floor. You can see the blood now. You can't feel the pain because your adrenaline. What's going through your head at that point?
No, when these guys ran away, and you know, the first is to call for help. And you know, unfortunately for me, there was my aunt was there. The sister of my father was having lunch in the same restaurant, so I called her, and she comes and look at me, and she goes run, and I told her call an ambulance. And then they start, you know, like thinking we cannot put you down because they're going to come back and hit you. And I say, no, get me downstairs, because it was a second floor. And then they come down and they put me on the floor. And then, you know, like a miracle, I believe two police guys came in a motorcycle. And I said, these guys are going to hit me again. No, but no, these guys were like angels that came in. And the guy came and said, hey, what happened? And tell, hey, I'm this guy. Please don't stay here. Don't move from my side. So that police guy died it was like a chunka, I believe it was there, and he was by my side. And then the ambulance comes, And they want to take one of my bodyguards that has a bullet in the head because he was alive, still was alive. And then the guy didn't want to take me. So I call him and say, hey, you can take us too. I can survive, you know. So no, and I got him from here and throw him down. Say, hey, man, I can save myself. So they put my bodyguard, Fernando, in I don't know how, the stretcher, you call it, and put him there. And I went, like, you see, the ambulance has like a seats all around. And I went laying down there. So they took me to the hospital. And like when I got there in 2 minutes, my wife was there. And then my cousin was there. And they say, what happened? And I told my cousin, those are, sorry about the word. Those are the word I'm going to say. Those two motherfuckers, you have to hide.
So it's, yeah, go on, keep going.
Yeah, and then my wife was there and she told me, and you know, I was so calm. I don't know why. I believe it was the adrenaline. It was, you know, like I was dying and my blood was going down. I was very calm. And then another miracle happens, you know. That's something, when you're not going to die, you're not going to die. My general medic was there. He was going to operate somebody, and then he sees me. And immediately the guy throws me in the operation room, and the guy saved my life. The guy was like, when I saw that guy, it was like I saw God. You know, the guy didn't let me die that day.
You had a few guardian angels that day. Going back to the other guardian angels then, it's quite common in Colombia for a hitman to dress as a cop. And you said as these cops were approaching you then, you thought it was going to happen again.
Yeah. It was, you know, I say this is it. But, you know, unfortunately, the guy was not involved in the hit. And the guy was an angel that sat there and protecting me.
But for that moment when you thought it was going to happen again, did you just brace and accept that there was nothing you could do?
Yeah, I cannot do nothing because I cannot move myself. I don't have nothing. So, yeah, it was like if it happened, it happened. No? It was God's decision, no? But he decided the opposite, to let me live.
But for a second there, it must have been terrifying.
Yeah, but, you know, I don't know why I was so calm. I don't explain myself. I from that moment that I tell you that I talked to this guy, that I talked to God, I was calm. You know, I knew I was not going to die that day. I knew that was not my day. I don't know if I put it in my head and that saved me, but I was positive 100% that I was not going to die.
So at this point then, where were Miguel and Gilberto?
They were in prison. They were in Bogota in a prison called La Picota. They were there. It was very hard for them, you know. Yeah, but things happened, and I went to operation. I wake up like the operation was like 5 hours. Like at 8 o'clock, I wake up. I was my wife was on my side, and then my father calls, and the first thing that I told my father that day is, Father, I'm alive. This is a war we cannot win. And I knew those guys were hearing me. That was the message that I have to give, because if I would have said something else, maybe they would come again for me. So I knew what I had to say, and really it was the truth. I knew that in that moment, those guys, we would lost that war, because they had the police, they had the guerrillas, they had a lot of people. And we had a lot of family, innocent family, that would be lost if we decided to go to war with those guys.
What was your father's reaction when you first told him that?
Yeah, he calmed himself. He was, you know, but always he told me if I was, well, how I was feeling, that how did I feel. And I said, don't worry, Father, I'll survive. Think about the other family members. And unfortunately, you know, we could, you know, resolve this issue with these people. And it was difficult because, you know, there were people who will help you and people who wanted war, because the guys who made the hits, they charge when you kill people. That's the way when they make money. So it was complicated, no? But in the end, you know, sense came true, and then we decided to to join, you know, like join forces to fight against projects in Congress that were very important against drug trafficking. And those guys wanted me to, you know, help them with that because I had the experience. So that saved my life too, I believe, you know. But there were very difficult moments, Sean, for me because, you know, I was every day was, you know, surviving death, surviving prison. But that's that life that I choose, and that's why I made so much mistakes, and I had to suffer for my bad actions.
So are you saying, from their perspective then, in the immediate aftermath, it was an unsuccessful hit because you survived?
Yeah, sure. Because in the end, they say I was not that object, but it was incredible. Those guys will do a hit and don't know who was there. No, that's stupid to know when people who were very organized, people who ran police and everything, they knew I was there, you know. But in the end, I survived, and some people help us, and we could resolve this issue, no? Because in the end, when you cannot make when you're gonna go to war, you have to think about it, because sometimes there are wars that when you're not gonna win the war, you have to make, you know, peace talks and bargain. And that's what we did, and because we had to survive, there were a lot of innocent people. We had a lot of people, you know, easy to be, you know, hit. We got a very big family, and there are people that didn't have nothing to do with what we were doing.
So you just said that they said you weren't the target. Who did they say was the target?
My main guy, the guy who ran, you know, he was a guy who had a lot of people in the street, and that's why they wanted to take him down. But I believe the guy who wanted the war, his name was Varela. He wanted to take out two birds with one stone, because this guy was a guy who ran a lot of people in the street, and I was the political power of this organization in that moment.
Wow. This is such a compelling story, William. I appreciate all the detail you've given us on this, and it must be true.
Yeah, but I'm telling all the story in the book, so nobody is gonna read the book.
I think they certainly will. It's right here. It's right here. Go down to the description box and check out the link, because there's a hell of a lot more detail in the book. All right, let's go back then and just set the stage for this, because in the Western speaking world, the people think it all just revolves about Pablo Escobar. And they've seen the narcos and the DEA go in, and they're the good guys, and they kick the bad guys' asses. But it's far more complex than that. I mean, the whole thing goes back to the violence in Colombia, doesn't it? There was a civil war called the violence. And could you just tell the viewers a little bit about that war, the violence, what it was about?
The problem, we have to go back to... Let's go back to 78 to 84. That was like a paradise for everybody in Colombia, because everybody was making money. Drug trafficking was like almost legal, because, you know, the banks are making money, the rich people are making money with these new, you know, rich guys in the block. But then this guy Escobar decided that he wanted to be president of Colombia. The great mistake he made, because the guys who ran our country for more than 100 years, there are 10 families in Colombia, they wouldn't permit that somebody who come from there will, you know, be in power in Colombia. So when he was outside of political, they wanted him because they were receiving a lot of, you know, benefits. But now he's getting involved in stuff that he shouldn't get involved. And then the problem started. He was a congressman, and then they took out all a lot of stuff that he had in the past, you know. He was cashed with some drugs in a moment, then they put that in the medias, and then this guy got crazy, and then decided he was going to make revenge against the political who were not with him. So he started to kill, you know, important people, and then he started putting bombs in Colombia. And now the thing that was good, you know, I'm not saying it was good. I'm saying that that's what people believe in those moments. And now this is like satanized, right? That this is, you know, the bad thing. And everybody had to suffer the consequences. So this guy made war against the government, against the establishment, against everybody. And you know, a lot of, you know, he blew out a plane. He put bombs of 500 kilos of dynamite in the street. So it was a very hard moment. And the only guys who in a moment decided to, you know, try to, not because they wanted, but because now he decided that now he wants to fight with the Cali cartel. And so the only people who put, you know, their chest against Escobar were the Cali cartel. And then the war started. When everybody was afraid of this guy, my father and uncle and their associates were the only guy who had the courage to, you know, meet this guy in the level that he wanted to fight. Because when you start fighting with no master like this guy, you have to be a master. Because, you know, you're gonna lose your life. You know, you have to change your values and fight. And he told my dad and uncle that he will kill him in 5 days, and my father and uncle killed him in 5 years. So that's a truth, and I only don't say it. That's something that everybody knows, that the Cali cartel was the main factor, not the DEA. You know, the Cali cartel was the main factor to kill Escobar, because we're the guy who were putting the money and putting the information to bring him down.
All right, let's go over some of this a bit more slowly then. What was it like for your dad and Gilberto, his brother, who became the bosses? What was it like for them as kids growing up in Colombia?
Very difficult, you know, because in Colombia, it's a country that has half of the population is in absolute poverty. How do you say poverty?
Poverty.
Yeah. So it's complicated, not to you know, be able to go up in the scale. You have to be, or a famous singer, or a famous soccer player, or a politician. Or you are born in a cradle of gold. That's the only way you can go up. So in those moments, you know, it was very hard for them. My uncle was the guy who started everything. You know, he decided to throw out his dad when he was 16 years old, I believe, and he decided to throw out his dad because he didn't provide for his family, and he took the responsibility of the family, and he worked. He worked, and then he was a very greedy and ambitious man, and then he decided to get involved in a lot of criminal activities. And my father was different, because my father, you know, my uncle wanted him to be a lawyer, a famous law person, and my father started studying, and my uncle was sacrificing himself so his brother could be, you know, a famous attorney. But in the end, this thing gets you involved, because, you know, sometimes my uncle needed some help from my dad, and then my dad got involved, and then, but in the start, my uncle was the main guy, you know, until he was the guy who initially this crime organization with Chepe Santa Cruz in 73, and they were putting cocaine in New York and controlling that market from 73 to like 80, you know, that was like the main, you know, cocaine boom in New York. And they were the guys who were involved in that. And then a lot of stuff happened over here in the United States. You know, the authorities started like put more attention into cocaine, because in the start, in the 70s, they were more, you know, in the mafia Italian with the heroin. So in 80, they had a lot of problems here. They almost captured my Chepe. They almost captured my uncle over here. And then, you know, they go back to Colombia. They continue. Then Escobar decided to kill the Ministry of Justice, and then everything blew up. Then my uncle decided to go and hide in Spain, and then he's captured in Spain, and then that's when my father became number one and was the guy who brought the cartel from here to the top, where they, because, you know, he got a lot of power because of this fight that he had with the American, legal fight that he had with the Americans. He had to corrupt a lot of politicians, important people in Colombia, and then he became, I believe, one of the most powerful men in that area. No, my father was never the man who more money had in the drug business, but he was the man who, he was the guy who had more power. You know,
that's interesting. You said that Gilberto was involved in all kinds of criminal activity before the drug trafficking. What criminal activity was he involved in?
He was robbing, you know, that's called, like, in Colombia, pilateria terrestre. That's like being a road pirate. He was robbing, you know, different merchandise, robbing stuff in different trucks and selling them. And then he became involved in activities of kidnapping, and a lot of stuff, you know, micro traffic. And then in 73, he decided to bring in the two first kilos to the States. And then he became, you know, one of the most important drug traffickers in the world.
So you said that your father was more studious then, you know, he had a law career planned out. What was, if his brother was getting into criminal activity, did that cause problems between the brothers? I mean, what was their relationship like back then?
No. I never saw a relationship between two brothers like they had. No, they were. I never saw my dad and uncle fight. I never saw a discussion. Maybe they had it in private, but I never saw that. They were one respecting him like his father, and the other one respecting him like the guy who saved him from the Americans in '84. You know, the guy who robbed them. Because my uncle should be extradited, being brought to United States in '84 from Spain. But my father, you know, did everything and was able to bring his brother back to Colombia and save them, you know, from in those days from being in American jail. So I believe there was an amazing relationship. I never saw one like that. And it's admirable, no? The two brothers can love us all so much and help them, and they, you know, be very close and be very, you know, be able to, you know, fight the ego, no? Because sometimes it's hard to fight the ego when you're running a top criminal organization.
The four bosses of the Cali cartel was your father, his brother Gilberto, Chepe, and Pacho. Who joined next? Was it Chepe?
No. The organization started my uncle and Chepe. Then my father came in, and Pacho. And Pacho came in like in 84, 85, when my father was in charge. He was the main guy who was receiving the cocaine for my dad, and was selling in New York. So they began very close. So that's why he became member like in 85, 86.
So are you
The original three guys are Gilberto, Chepe, and Miguel.
So are you saying that Chepe then came in before your father? In that case, was Chepe a crime partner for Gilberto before the drug trafficking? Is that how they knew each other?
Yeah. They were the associates from you know, like the '70s. You know, they were very close.
So Narcos shows Chepe as this larger-than-life character, you know, very brave, action. There's always action around him. What was he like in real life?
He was a joker, you know. He was always making fun. He was, you know, he was a very dangerous man, but he was always a good character. And I know him when I'm 12 years old, you know, because he's in the parties of my family. And I always liked him, you know, because he was a very likable guy, but he was very dangerous, but he was a very jokeful guy. He was, you know, always making fun of you, always laughing. He was a very likable guy.
So did Gilberto and Chepe, did they have their own crew doing these robberies? Did they have a lot of guys with them before the trafficking?
They were together and they had a band, you know, they were a crew and they were part of the crew.
And then Pacho, what was he like in real life?
I didn't have a lot of contact with that guy. I saw him like 5 or 6 times in my life. You know, he was like most, you know, very quiet guy, very, very, you know. And my father didn't like us to be around him.
What year were you born?
I was born in 1965.
So what's your first memories?
My first memories? No, not very good memories because, you know, I had a very difficult childhood because that relationship between my father and my mother was never good. My mother was a very difficult person and my father was a bohemian guy. He wanted to, you know, be a party all the time. So it was very difficult relationship. It was not a close one. And when I was 5 years, I almost died because they had to, you know, take one of my kidneys. You know, it was my childhood was not very good. Then my mother makes a radical decision and decides to bring me to United States and leave my father. She almost kidnapped me, you know. She brought me here without my father. I didn't saw my father for 5-6 years. And it was hard, no? And then we went back to Cali, and then I looked for my father, and then I decided not to live with her or even him. I decided to go and live with Gilberto's wife. And I believe that was like the best, you know, time that I had, because really, like from 79 to 84, 85, when things were like, no, 84 were, you know, normal. We live a normal life. It was like the best memories that I have, no, that because it was normal. We were normal kids, you know, studying, playing soccer. But then came this situation on Gilberto, and that changed our lives.
So when you left for America, how old were you?
Like 6.
And when you came back, how old were you?
11, like 11.
And did you notice the difference in the standard of living because the drug money was coming in then when you came back?
Sure, sure. My father in those moments, you know, was, wow. He was, you know, like I say, at night and the day, he was a very successful businessman because he had 3 or 4 different companies, big companies. He had a soccer team, you know. He was very, you know, known for everybody. He was famous in the city. But in the night, he was one of the drug lords of the world, you know. That was they did a lower life, you know, in those moments. And they knew how to run themselves. They knew how to, you know, people didn't talk. You know, I found out they were involved in this activity of drug trafficking in 84 when Gilberto is captured in Spain. You know, we had like some rumors, but in the end, you know, it was a normal life and it was a good life for us. So you're not asking questions. You're, you know, because you live good. You only have to study to get benefits. So that's, for us, it was normal. And my father and uncle in those days, if you see him, they were only running around with 1 or 2 guys.
All right, William. So from what you just said then, you were about 19 years old when you realized what
I'm like 18 years old.
18. And just to give the backstory for that then, so the highest level official ever to be assassinated in those years was the Minister of Justice, Lara Bonilla, by Escobar, which caused many cartel leaders to flee Colombia. Now, before we get to the story of your father going to Spain and his brother going to Spain, what, you know, did Pablo Escobar consult the Cali bosses? Did he let them know he was going to assassinate Lara Bonilla?
No. In those moments, they didn't know nothing about that. And then when that happened, everybody had to, you know, fly away. I believe my uncle made a mistake. He should have stayed in Colombia because in the end, they were going to go against Medellin, the government. But he decided to go to Spain, and I believe that was one of his great mistakes, you know, because when he was captured over there, everybody knew really who Gilberto Rodriguez was, even us, you know, as a family. He's one of the biggest drug lords in the world, no? Because nobody knew. Everybody was talking about Escobar. And no, Escobar didn't ask nobody whenever he did something. He did it then he brought us to meetings when my father was involved and told him that he wanted to do that. And then my father told him that it was his decision, that we were not gonna get involved in that our fight was a legal fight. But I believe that was like that started like break up the relationship because we didn't follow him.
Hey, so if you're enjoying this podcast, William's book is available worldwide, Son of the Cali Cartel. It is mind-blowing. It's on Amazon as an ebook, audiobook, and the paperback. And you saw the Cali Cartel as represented in Narcos. A lot of that was BS. William lays it down, what really happened. His dad was one of the leaders of the biggest coke cartel in the world at that time. And when his dad went to prison, William was running it. And it starts out with the assassination attempt on William, where he gets shot up and his friends die. So again, check out William's book, Son of the Cali Cartel. Links will be in the description box below this video on the YouTube version. Cheers.
And in the end, he was going to find something to go against us, you know, because this is the way he saw it. He believed he was invincible and he can fight. You cannot fight a war against anybody at the same time, because in the end, you're going to lose. You know? That's what happened to Babylon, no? Yeah, he was fighting with five or six organizations, you know, the government, the guerrillas, the Cali cartel, the other people that were surrounding him. So in the end, you have to lose when you lose your... I believe he lost his head.
What's interesting then is that Pablo Escobar's business partners were the Ochoa brothers. And when you guys' bosses went to Spain, didn't they go with the Ochoa's brothers? Wasn't Jorge Ochoa?
We wanted the Ochoa's brother, Jorge Luis, you know, because my uncle knew him from... My uncle was a friend of Jorge Luis because they were involved in a bank in Panama in the 80s. And so he knew them. Then he met over there, Jorge Luis, in Spain, and then they got caught.
Okay, so now they've been caught and they're facing extradition to America. So what legal strategy was employed so that they wouldn't be extradited to America?
My father decided to, take the same crime that my uncle did in the United States, and he opened the same case in Colombia. So, you know, because the crime started in Colombia and finished in the United States. So that's what he did. So the United States was asking him for this, and then my father made up this other case, and this judge was asking for my uncle in extradition from Colombia. So that was the strategy that he started, but it was a very crazy and hard, you know, process. A lot of money was spent to try to save my uncle, and a lot of corruption was done in Spain and Colombia to achieve this goal.
So this case that was made up then, did it involve bull smuggling?
Drug? No, that was Jorge Luis Ochoa, that was what he did. It was different strategies. No, our strategy was the same crime that my uncle was charged in the United States for bringing cocaine over here was open in Colombia. It was about cocaine. Jorge Luis was about bullfighters.
I see. Okay, yeah. So he managed to get sent back to America as well. So are you saying then that money ended up with the judges in Spain to make that happen?
Not the judges, but a lot of people with a lot of influence in that country, you know, they were the guys who got the money, and and help my father achieve this hard and difficult fight, win this battle, no? Because in the end, it was a battle that we won.
All right, so you're 18. You find this out. What goes through your head?
Well, it was crazy. It blew up our not only mine, my other, I believe some of my cousin knew, but the one who was almost the same age as mine, we didn't know. So it was very hard for us. We, you know, felt betrayed because in the end was, you know, everybody was now putting the finger in us. That's what we believe, no? Because, you know, you start like making up, everybody's looking at us. But in the end, it was our family. It was our uncle. We loved him. And they were good with us. We had a good life. You know, we had everything we wanted. We study and be, you know, that was like our part of the bargain of we have to you know, bring, because it was like a contract we had with my uncle. This we is that if we achieve and be good students and achieve our goals, we will get you know, and things and it changed. No, that's like what he taught us. No, that everything we have to win it, and that I believe it was a very good way to the way he, you know, broke us up, because in the end that make us people, responsible people, no? And what I tell you, so in the end we, you know, we decided to be loyal, to, you know, sit beside them and try to be loyal and accomplish, go to Spain, spend time with my uncle. When he came back to Colombia, every Saturday we have to be in the jail, you know, from 8 o'clock of the morning to 4 o'clock of the afternoon, you know, trying to be with him and being loyal to our family, you know. And those moments, you know, I saw that relationship to my father and uncle, and my father was a lawyer, so that's when I decided to be a lawyer.
What was it like visiting him in Spain?
You know, it was difficult because the jails in Spain are hard, like here, like in United States. I believe in United Kingdom must be the same. You know, I never was in a jail before, but it was, you know, it was a mirror here, and we have to talk about, you know, pressing a button. It was very hard, you know, to see him that way, but in the end, that was, you know, the fate that he you know, brought up to him.
Was he confident about his case, or was he worried?
No, very worried. You know, it was, I believe it was 70-30, you know, United States will get him, but, you know, my father never surrendered, and he achieved that.
So when your father got back, did he have to go in the prison in Colombia for a period of time?
When my uncle comes back, and like my uncle goes back in 85, something like that. And he has to stay like 2 years in prison to 97. To 87, sorry. So 87, from 85 to 87 in jail. And then in 87, he was released.
Okay. And what was your father doing during that time?
He was managing the Cali cartel and part of the legal business, no? My uncle was like the guy who was more involved in running the legal business. He was, you know, now he's in Colombia, so now he's running the legal business. My father is running the other business, the legal one.
And what was the Cali cartel's relationship with the government like during those years?
Good, because, you know, we were spending a lot of money, you know, bribing them and being close to them. We were, you know, allies in those moments, because they help us, you know, achieve this goal of bringing my uncle back from Spain.
How did things deteriorate with Pablo Escobar and you guys?
Something happened in New York. Two employees, one from Pacho Herrera and one from him, got involved in a conflict. I believe it was for a girl or something like that. And then I believe Pacho's guy killed this guy. And then Pablo asked for the head of this man. And then Pacho didn't want to surrender him. And then now Escobar not only wants the guy, he wants Pacho too. And then my father and uncle said, we don't surrender our friends. If you want to fight, let him fight. And then they found out that he was going for all for them. So that's when the war started.
What about Virginia Vallejo? Was she sleeping with Escobar and sleeping with Gilberto? For people who don't know who she is, she's a very famous TV presenter.
That's what they say. I don't know. I cannot say yes or no, but that's what people say.
Okay. So as things deteriorated with Escobar then, how did your life change?
Well, it changed a radical, man, because, you know, I only was, you know, we were running around with one guy, and then I have like four guys behind me. I have five or four guys, bodyguards, all my family. Now we used to have like two, three guys in our security. Now we have like 100. And then life changed forever, no? Because now we have this guy on top of us. And we have this awful world, you know, with people with guns around us. But that's the only way we can survive.
What were the first attacks Escobar launched against Cali?
He started burning our drugstores, our pharmacies. And he started burning them in Medellin and trying to get to my father and uncle. No, there were a lot of people coming and going from Medellin to Cali trying to assassinate my father and uncle. And then the same, no, they were sending people to Medellin to try to hit this core.
There's still a lot of noise, William, from the table. Is there like something on the table that's making the noise?
Let me take it out. Now it's better?
Okay, yeah. All right, so the war's heating up with Cali and Escobar, and the government now, are they coming after Escobar only, and are you guys, you know, joining with the government against Escobar?
And first it was that way, no? And first it was only the government against Escobar, and we're helping the government. And in 89... this guy in El Mexicano, Gacha, decided to kill Galán, one of our president, you know, candidates from Colombia. And then another, you know, big wave came against drug trafficking, against the government. And then I believe that saved my uncle and father's life, because they had to hide themselves. They were not going, they were not, you know, looking so hard for them, but they had to, you know, not be in their houses, you know, they had to be mobile. And then I believe that saved them their life, because my father was always in the same place and Escobar was, you know, in the end he was going to get to him. So that's, unfortunately, it's a very sad part of the story of our country, but in the end, I believe it saved my father's uncle's life.
Do you know how the assassination of Galán was organized by Gacha?
They bribed one of his close bodyguards, and he knew where he's gonna be there. But I believe he's suicidating, so because he knew they were gonna kill him, and then he still went to that part of the country was the domain of Gacha, and he should not be there. So, you know, and they killed him, you know.
So do you think he was partially responsible for his own death then, because he
No, it's because it's crazy to say that, because, you know, he shouldn't be, you know, he should have been able to go anywhere he wanted, but in the end it was a very difficult zone. It was very, you know, very brave, I don't know, him trying to go there, but in the end, it was a great mistake, because he was killed.
Okay, so in the West, some key figures in the story are often left out, and people are not very familiar with the Castaño brothers. Could you explain to people who they were?
They were like a faction of the right wing. They were fighting a war against the guerrillas, the left wing. And the Castaños became paramilitaries in like in the 80s, because
we got the noise again, William.
The the FARC kill their father, and then they become involved, and they become one of the high groups of right wing, and fought a war against the guerrillas.
Okay, and in the beginning, they had a good relationship with Pablo Escobar, didn't they?
Yeah, they were working with him, and they were against us. But in the end, they find out that he was going to kill them, and they, you know, came over here to the side of my father and uncle. And then there were the guys who helped with my father and uncle putting the money, build the Pepes. The Pepes were the guys who, in the end, finished off Escobar's organization.
Okay, so do you believe then that Pablo Escobar starting to kill his business associates was the beginning of the end for him, because he killed other people before the Castaños realized?
Yeah, because the guy, you know, he at the end, he made so much chaos in Colombia. He killed so many people. He blew up our airplane. In the end, he got what he wanted. You know, he got a prison that he built, and he was saved there. It was very difficult to get to him because he was, you know, protective with police and the army. In the government, so I believe he lost it killing those two men, those two best partners. You know, those guys were very high objects for my father and uncle in the war against him, because were the guys who were giving the money to fight the war against us. And I don't know, these guys lost it. He decided to kill them because those guys were just bored, you know, to giving all their money to this guy to fight wars against everybody. And then I believe that was one of the most important mistakes the second most important mistake the squad made, you know, because in that moment he lost the war. You know why? Because people who knew his organization, you know, they were, you know, sometimes working together, decided to come over here. So now we know how he operates, who the guys are, and they were easy to, you know, finish them off.
So you're talking about the assassination of the Moncada and Galeano factions at the at the cathedral. And these are people that he was really close to. And Roberto...
I believe in the list there were three or four in the list of my uncle and dad, you know, to hit. Because we're the guys who put in the money to fight the war against us, you know. So I believe it was one of the greatest mistakes, because the people who were around the Moncadas and Galeano came over here to Cali to ask for protection. And now we know how he operated, who were the close person he had, how they, where they hide. And so it was easy to finish him off.
And one of those people was Don Berna. Who was Don Berna, if you could tell the people?
Don Berna was one of the Moncadas' main guys, and the guy, or Galeanos. I don't know which are the two fractions. I believe it was more with the Galeanos. And then he became, you know, one of the main guys for us to be involved in the persecution in Escobar. And he was infiltrated in the group of the police that was against Escobar, the Grupo de Búsqueda. And he was operating with them, with the police group, you know, against Escobar, and did a lot of, and he was the day they killed Escobar in the operation.
Yeah, so I've read Don Berna's book, Killing the Boss, and he describes going out to Cali to meet the Cali guys for the first time. He, you know, he was apprehensive to make this alliance. Do you remember, did you ever meet Don Berna? Do you remember any of that?
I met Don Berna, but after that, you know, I met Don Berna in 1996 before my hit, in a meeting that I was with the Castaño when they kill Chepe. I had to go and had a meeting with them. And I saw Don Berna two times in my life, that day and another day, like in 2001, something like that. But the first time I saw Berna was the day that I had the meeting with the Cali the North Valley cartel leaders in the right wing Castaños faction in Monteria. I had that meeting.
Okay, could you describe who Los Pepes were and how they started?
Los Pepes were perseguidos for, you know, persecuted for Pablo Escobar. Those guys were the partners of the Boncada and the Galeano and some paramilitaries like the Castaño Brothers. There was that group. It was formed to annihilate, how do you say the word? Annihilate? To kill, to destroy Escobar. And it was all these people were financed by my father and uncle in the Cali cartel.
Yeah, because the U.S. tries to, you know, if people go back and read books like Killing Escobar, U.S. Special Forces, the DEA, the CIA, you know, they're all trying to take credit for it. But actually, it was financed by the Cali cartel. On the ground, you've got the Castaño brothers, you've got Don Berner, you've got Los Pepes. But they were working in collaboration with the police, weren't they? Because they had the equipment to track him.
Yeah, they say, you know, I think DEA was more important in the falling of the Cali cartel than in the Medellin falling. Because the DA was giving information and was giving some equipment to authorities to find this guy, right? And I believe, like, let's say the American authorities had 20% of Escobar, destroying Escobar. I believe the government, Colombia government, had another 20%, and the Cali cartel and the Pepes and all guys, like 60% of destroying Escobar. That's the truth of the story. It's not only I say it, a lot of people have said it. And that's the real story, right? Because that's how Americans work. They don't care, they hook up with somebody to destroy the organization, then they go for you. And then when they're with you, they're trying to, with this other organization, you know, try to make alliance to destroy you. And that's the way American destroy, you know, all these organizations.
So how did you hear about Escobar's death?
Excuse me? I didn't hear you.
When did you hear that Pablo Escobar was dead?
I was in a meeting of my firm of lawyers. We were talking about some problems, legal problems that we had to resolve. And then somebody called me and told me that Escobar was dead. And immediately I called my father and he confirmed the death of Escobar.
Okay, so in Don Berner's book, Killing the Boss, he claims that he, Don Berner, and his cousin, Seed, were in the house assassinating Escobar before the police, you know, before the media, and they were told to leave. Do you think that Don Berner was telling the truth?
Part of the truth, I believe, was the hit and score was a combination in the paramilitaries. That's true. His cousin was there, but two or three policemen were involved too in the shooting at score. And so then when this guy, the head of this group came, he told Don Berner to leave, but the operation was a combination of between police and the Pepes who killed Escobar.
Okay, and then when the government, the president, he said, these are the men who killed Escobar, and he told the media, you know, these policemen, but Pepes had to disappear, did they, because they were an illegal death squad?
Yeah, sure. But nobody wanted to, you know, the government was not going to accept that the Pepes in the Cali cartel has killed Escobar. No, it was a win of the government and the establishment. But in the end, it was a combination of all this thing, because the Escobar was not only dead that day. It was a war. It was fought. All in 5 years, and it was, you know, we were destroying him little by little, because he was a very difficult man. He was a very very dangerous person and a very you know, very intelligent man. So it was not easy. It was a process. It was a process that was very, that was a lot of money spent and a lot of blood, you know. What was you know.
What was the atmosphere like in Cali when Escobar died? Did you guys feel safe?
Yeah, it was like, you know, we had like, it was like two feelings. Like, yeah, we were safe. What's going to happen? I believe it was the most important moment of my father. He had to resolve a lot of issues of his life. But I believe in those moments, you know, pride and, you know, ego, everything came forward because he believed he was invincible. And then that's the day when he lost, because he should have, you know, tried to surrender himself like the Ochoa brothers did and resolve all these issues with the authorities. But, you know, he was Mr. Miguel Rodriguez. He was the number one man in the world, and he believed he could achieve anything. But I believe the Americans and the families who control Colombia gave them a little bit, for a little while, the power, and now they wanted to take it back. So that's the story. You know, you have to read in my book how all of this things happen and how really was this Escobar story, no?
All right. So when Escobar was assassinated then, what was the atmosphere for Cali? Did you guys feel a lot safer at that point?
Yeah, like for our lives, we feel a lot of safer because those guys were now the new, you know, drug bosses of Colombia, and everybody respected us in those days. But in the end, it was a very, you know, difficult situation because I believe my father and Uncle Blue, the most important opportunity they have to, you know, like, you know, resolving all those legal issues that we had. But I believe they lost it, no? Because they had won a battle against the Americans, and now they brought down Escobar, so they believe they were invincible, and I believe they messed it up because they had that, this great opportunity, and they lost it.
Okay, and do you think that your father then, he believed that because he'd been instrumental in taking Escobar down, that the Colombian government would prevent his extradition to America?
Yeah, he believed that. No, he believed that he had so many relationships with all those politicians, and he had, you know, he believed that he has the structure to, you know, be able to not be sent to United States. And in those moments, it was easy to think that because, you know, the extradition didn't exist between United States and Colombia, so he believed he was safe. But America was working, you know, was working. And in the end, they were going to try to put in place this tradition again.
So imagine at that point in time, then you guys must have been heroes in the eyes of the government because they had struggled against Escobar for so long.
Yeah, but you know, this is momentarily, you know, because you had, you know, in those moments, my father had all the police by his side, a lot of people, politicians, high profile people from the government. But in the end, the government was finishing his period. Was another you know, government was gonna come in place, and then everything was gonna go change. And United States decided, you know, to pressure Colombian authorities, so they wanted to change the police, you know, who ran the police in those moments. And then they did it, and they put somebody that was in their pocket, and then he came for us.
Who was that?
Rosso José Serrano.
Okay.
Known as one of the best policemen in the world. No, that's ironic. you know, but my father and uncle made him famous because they should have surrendered and not let this guy, you know, say that he finished the Cali cartel.
How did the Ochoa brothers get through all this so safely? Because it seems like everybody else ended up dead or something really bad happened to them.
Yeah, there were three brothers. One unfortunately got involved with some people who were, you know, drug trafficking. I don't believe he was doing drug trafficking, but he was, you know, like lending money to those people, and he got hooked up in an operation in 2000, and he was sent to the United States, and he's doing 30 years.
Hope you're enjoying this podcast. There's a word from our sponsor, Rocket Money. The other day, I had to cancel 3 Amazon Prime memberships. I had a personal on the UK Amazon, US Amazon, company account, US Amazon, UK Amazon. Do you understand how hard it is to cancel these bloody things? That's why Rocket Money makes these things so much easier, formerly known as Truebill. The app shows all your subscriptions in one place and cancels what you don't want for you. Rocket Money can even find subscriptions you didn't know you were paying for. Just like with me, with my 4 Amazon Prime memberships, you may find out you've been at least double charged for a subscription. To cancel a subscription, all you've got to do is press cancel and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Cancel unnecessary subscriptions with Rocket Money today. Go to rocketmoney.com/Sean, S-H-A-U-N. Seriously, it could save you hundreds per year. That's rocketmoney.com/Sean, S-H-A-U-N. Thank you for supporting our sponsor, Rocket Money. Links in the description box. Cheers.
The other two, one died, you know, being a free man, and the other one is still there. I believe that they are really the guys who are the most intelligent drug lords because they were in the top and now they live a normal life, no? Because they knew how to lower their profile because they decided to forget about everything. But my father and uncle forgot about drug trafficking, but they didn't forget about power.
Do you ever talk to the Ochoa brother who's alive? Is it okay?
I only talked to the guy who is over here, Fabio, because when I was fighting one of those projects that the Americans were bringing up against us in Congress, I met to him to ask him for some money to help us, and he said he was going to give like $100,000, and I said, no, don't worry. Thank you. But we believe, you know, they would understand that in the end, all of the factions are going to suffer, no? But in those moments, people believe that those laws only were for the Rodriguez.
So do you believe that the U.S. government will work with a cartel to destroy another cartel, and then they always need a boogeyman?
Yeah, history has shown that. No, it's not. I can say history has shown that. And if you see what happened in different parts of the world, that's the main way that they did it. And not that they are associated with us, but they, you know, they look for the other way for a moment for these people and make us grow and then we, you know, destroy ourselves. I believe that war was the most stupid thing that could happen because in the end, Pablo Escobar destroyed himself and we destroyed ourselves too.
So the Castano brothers, who were instrumental in finding Escobar with Don Berner and, you know, the shootout and Don Berner saying he was there with his brother Seed, all that kind of stuff in the house, those guys had to disappear. Because the media, you know, it couldn't be reported that the Colombian government was working with this death squad. But did the Castaño brothers then turn against you guys because they were involved in the death of Chepe?
The first person of the Castaño brother was Fidel, the oldest one. He was the guy who had honor and had word. The other one was a bandit, Carlos. And Carlos was a mercenary, so he was beside the guy who was giving money. We were not giving money anymore to him. And now the North Valley cartel was financing all his activities, so he decided to go with them and betrayed us.
And he set Chepe up for death?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. That's what happened.
So when
later on, he was sending, you know, emissaries to my dad to say he was, you know, that he would have made a mistake, but in the end, there was, you know, only trying to, trying to hide his shame.
If Chepe came in second into the Cali cartel, so him and Gilberto must have been, you know, really close, bonded for so many years. What effect did Chepe's death have on Gilberto and Miguel?
Excuse me, I didn't understand the question.
Did it break the hearts of your father and Gilberto?
Yeah, sure. My father was most close to Chepe. He loved him like a brother. But in the end, you know, my father, you know, felt like betrayed by him because he didn't tell him that he was gonna escape, and that was a very hard moment for my dad and uncle. They almost were extradited by the government in those moments. And so it brought a lot of heat to us for what he did. But sure, it broke their hearts because they loved him. But we couldn't show that because, you know, we couldn't show that we were, you know, heartbreaking because it would be, you know, very dangerous for us.
So that was 96, was it, when Chepe died?
96, yeah, 96.
And the assassination attempt on you was what year?
Mine, the same year.
Okay. So by 96 then, the North Valley Cartel, is that becoming the most powerful?
Yeah, there was in the moment that they were more powerful, no? Because they had the paramilitaries guys, the right wing with them, and they had the police that was run from a police that was their associate that was called Danilo Gonzalez. That guy was the main guy. If you had a Danilo Gonzalez, you will win any war you want because he had the police by his side.
So if you are a cocaine cartel in Colombia in those years and you've got the right wing killing communists on your side, does that mean you get protection from the government for that period of time?
No, I don't believe that. I believe that, you know, that I tell you, there's fractions that they're like waves, you know. First was Escobar here, and then he fell, and the Cali cartel up here, and then the Cali cartel falls, and now the North Valley cartel is here, now they fall, and now another cartel comes, because that's the way it works, no? And because we become objects of the authorities, and we become medals for police and the EA, you know, those guys. So we're like, how you say that? Pray? We're like, pray that we're worth something when we got a lot of value, and that's what happened, you know. We become more important, and now we're the object.
So did Don Berner stay with you guys, or did he go with the Castaños?
No, he went with the Castaños.
Did he?
Mm-hmm.
So what happened to him?
He went to prison. He's over here. He was extradited. They brought over here to the United States.
Do you know what year he went to prison?
He went to prison like 2006, 2008, something like that.
So did he have a period of success then while you guys were going down?
Yeah, because, you know, first was Escobar, then it was Rodriguez, then there was the North Valley Cartel, then it was a freshman, a guy called Varela. That guy was our enemy. They wasn't tough. Then there was one of these guys, main guys who killed Varela, was Comba. And then came the paramilitary groups. So they, you know, they become number one object for the United States.
All right. So we're in 1996 now. There's been the assassination attempt on you. Are you starting to think about the consequences of this now because you've seen it in real life, the deaths of your friends?
I believe I started to see the consequences of my life and when I was hit, like my attempt on my life. That's when I changed the way I saw, because I was running stuff like 2 years, and then I believe I was untouchable. I was becoming my dad. And then, you know, when this happened, now I knew that in the end, I was going to go to jail, I was going to get killed. So I really, you know, decided to change this life and become different, no? But I was trapped because I was, you know, it's not an excuse, but in the end, I had a lot of obligations with a family, you know, and I had to be loyal to them.
And how easy was that? I mean, you've just seen your friends get killed. I mean, your gut instinct would be to kill, to want to kill the people who killed your friends.
Yeah, sure. That's the normal thing that you're gonna think about. But you have to know where are you and who are your enemy, and you cannot be a kamikaze because you know you have a lot of family, a lot of innocent people. They're gonna get killed if you make a mistake. So I learned, you know, to live like the Greek people. They say you should, you know, sit in the balcony of your house to see when the dead guy passes, you know, in his box. So that's the way I learned to live and wait, because I knew these type of guys, they were very violent and they're gonna kill themselves between. So that's what happened. They all killed themselves, one against the other one, because of power and ignorance.
Had you learned lesson also from Pablo Escobar's son making the mistake when his dad died? He did a radio interview and he said he was going to be more tough than his father and he was going to kill the guys that killed his father. But then he realized quite quickly that was a mistake. Had you been paying attention to that?
But I believe he was a little kid. He was 14 years old, you know, but it was a very dangerous moment of his life because he was gonna kill. And if you read the book of one of his books of him, the guy who saved him, it was my dad. My dad didn't let him be killed, you know, and told him that I cannot protect you anymore. Go and leave Colombia. But you cannot take, you know, a little kid. Well, he was hurt, but I believe he did the right thing. Leave Colombia and become a good person, and because he's a good man. I know him. I have a relation with him. And I believe he did the correct.
And people often ask, you know, where did Escobar's money go? Did a lot of the money have to be given to the Cali cartel because they took over?
That's what, you know, I believe one of the mistakes that maybe Juan Pablo says is that, because a lot of people got their money, but the Cali cartel didn't get. My father and uncle only got a building that was not even his. It was the Galeanos building in Medellin. The other things at Escobar were you know, given to the Pepes. You know, that's what happened, because there a lot of those you know properties were taken by Escobar to other people.
So you're saying the Castaño brothers got a lot of Escobar's wealth?
Yeah, Escobar, Don Berna, all those people got a lot of stuff. We only got a building in Medellin that Pablo Escobar. It was the Galeanos building. It was a very expensive building in Medellin. That's the only thing we got from that war.
Okay, so you say you were trapped then. You wanted, you know, to somehow stop it because you saw the consequences. But it's like you're at a, it's so big. It's like you're at a ship. You're captain of a ship at sea. You can't turn the ship that easily, can you?
You know what happened with me, my channel, and my friend. I got the plane when the plane was going down, and one of the engines was in flames. So that's what I have to manage, you know. In those moments, a lot of, you know, it was a very difficult situation. My father and uncle were in jail. We're not getting the cash that we used to manage. And we had a lot of people against us and fighting against the American, fighting against the establishment. It was very difficult moments, no? And that's what I had to live. But I tried to do my best because I was a loyal soldier for my dad and uncle. But in the end, we were gonna lose the war because you, to the Americans, you win battles, but the war in the end, you're gonna lose if you don't bargain with them.
So the Cali cartel was famous then for having hiding places in walls, and sometimes, you know, when the police would come, your dad or Gilberto would hide in the walls. Is it Cayeta? Is that what it's called?
Caletas.
Could you
manage, my friend? That's the sad part of this. No, you're the most powerful man in Colombia, and you have to hide in a caleta and a wall to survive. So that's the life you want. In the end, that's what you have to think. No, it's worth it that being the most powerful man and you have to get in a wall to survive. Is that the life that people wanted? That's what you want to be. That's what people have to think about it.
Did you ever have to hide in a caleta?
No, never, never. Unfortunately, when I was, hiding for more than four years, I decided to leave Cali and go to the countryside and to the jungle and hide there. It was easier. And I ran with two or three people by my side. That was easier. And I had a lot of luck. God was with me, and I was a very disciplined person. You know, I was hiding, really. I was hiding. I was not fooling around. I was 24/7 trying to not get cut.
So there was a guy on the inside who was high up in your security, Jorge Salcedo?
Jorge Salcedo.
What did he do?
Hi, guys. Here's my morning routine. First, I drink olive oil, like a lot of it. Yep, that's good. Then I stare at a red light. It's the kind that helps your cells positively glow. Oh, wow, really bright, okay. Next, I take an ice bath. That's how you melt your fat and fix your, I don't know, other stuff. Ooh, yep, feeling super healthy. Can't fit my toes. Breakfast is raw liver. Okay, here we go. Oh, real good.
If your health advice sounds strange coming from a kid, maybe it's just strange. Cygnos pairs AI with a biosensor so you can track your body's unique responses to food, movement, and more in real time, helping you achieve your health goals. No fads, no fear, just your signal. Get $10 off select plans at cygnos.com. That's cygnos.com with code SPARK. Cygnos.
The only important thing that guy did in his life was give up my father, no? And he made a book, and now he's like James Bond, no? But the guy, he made a lot of stories, but everybody believed him. But in the end, the only important thing that he did, and it was very important because he was the guy who gave up my father, the main guy of the Cali cartel. Yeah, that's Jorge Salcedo.
And he was your father's, was his head security?
No. He was the guy who was running communications in the Cali cartel. You know, when the war started, the chief of security of my dad bring him aboard. And this guy was the guy who was running that part of the operation, the communication, you know. And the guy was the guy who was, you know, they had a big computer, and they were taking the incoming calls from Medellin in Colombia and mixing it up in Cali and see if this guy, you know, suspicious number that we have from Medellin calls that house, then this guy is now an object. And so they start following the guy, and then they take him to see what were they doing. That was the main, you know, operation that Jorge Salcedo was doing. And then when the war was won and everything happened, then this guy, you know, because he was, you know, he was an intelligent man, you have to say it. He started, you know, taking down like people close to my dad to get near him. And then he surrendered this person that was called El Mayor del Basto. He was the main security man of my father. He surrendered him. He gave him up to the authorities, and then now he became like very close to my dad, and that's the way he started, you know, telling where my dad was.
How were you captured?
I never was captured, my friend. I surrendered myself. I surrendered myself in Panama, and was brought here to the United States. But I was not captured. I surrendered myself.
What led to you surrendering yourself?
I believe my two kids and my wife. I believe I had run more than 4 years And my father was already over here. And when I saw my father get on the plane, I knew he lost his war against the Americans. And then it was my turn to try to resolve my problem, no? And unfortunately, I did. And I gave my kids an opportunity to live a different life. Like being in Colombia, they will never be who they are here, you know, because there we will be. That's William's kid. This is the granddaughter of Miguel Rodriguez. So I believe here there are normal people and they're doing amazing.
How much prison time did you serve?
I did 5 years.
Was that in the federal, U.S. federal system?
A federal institution, yeah.
Okay. And what year were you released?
2010.
2010. Okay. And what was it like coming out?
Difficult, no? Adapting yourself to, you know, I was lost in space, I say, because it's not only the 5 years that I was running, 5 years in prison. There were 4 more years running. They were more difficult than being in prison. We're talking about 9 years when you are totally, you know, out there. I lost with computers and all that
technology.
There's something very very funny, you know, when I got out in 2010, I got in a friend's car, you know, a BMW, and the guy told me, hey, why don't you drive? So I got in the car and my God, and where's the key? You know, it's not that button. So I was lost in technology for a long time because it was 10 almost 10 years of, you know, being hiding and being in prison. It's not easy, but I believe like in 6 months you adapt yourself to a normal life. But because at first, you know, and the noise, a lot of people, that was like very stressful for me. But in the end, you adapt yourself. And unfortunately, I knew I had to adapt myself to my home because in the end, I was the stranger now. You know, my 2 kids and my wife been by themselves for 9 years. So unfortunately, she waited for me and she gave the principles to my kids. And I'll never have... I don't believe nothing to pay her, no, all she done for my 2 kids and for me.
Well, that's good to hear, man. So are you able to visit your father, or is that not allowed?
I see him like 3 times when I came out, you know, but now for COVID is very difficult, that situation. At first was difficult too. And well, let's see what happened with this COVID thing, because 12 prisons are still, you know, by those restrictions.
And your uncle, you know, he'd served a lot of prison time. Was his death a surprise, Gilberto?
No, he was sick. No, he was sick a long time. And in the end, it's very sad, no, that he died in a prison cell. And that's, but in the end, that's the choose that you make, you know, in life. You know, I always say that when you decide this type of life, you have glory and you have the boom, but then you have the fall, and in the end, you will end dead, or you land in, or you die in a prison. So unfortunately, my uncle died there, and it's very sad.
Does your dad have a release date?
Yeah, he'll be out in, I believe, March of the 2030.
In 2030?
Mm-hmm, 2030.
2030, so he's got 8 more years. Yes.
No, 7 years to go.
Oh, 7 more years. Mm-hmm. And how does he pass the time in prison? Does he have a routine that he told you about?
The only way you have to survive in prison, you have to do a routine. No, you have to do a lot of exercise, read, and you know that's the only way you can pass the days. No, and so he has a routine. He works a lot now, but now it's complicated with the COVID thing. They don't let him go out to the yard. It's hard. No, it's being in prison. It's not easy.
So when I interviewed Pablo Escobar's son, he said he gets messages every day from people who've watched Narcos, and they say, I want to be like your dad. And he says, no, you don't want to be like my dad. What do you say to these young men who think it's cool to be a gangster?
Well, I'm gonna tell them the truth. No, I'm not gonna try to sell them a story that's not is. The one that Netflix and those platforms sell to those guys, those kids, that this is a glamour, this amazing, this is the life that you should expect. I believe not, because I didn't learn this by reading a book. This was not a story that somebody told me. I lived it, no, and I believe it was a very hard life that I have to, you know, suffer for my bad actions. I was shot 8 times. I was running for 4. I was in prison 5 years. Now I'm an asylum. I just say asylum, asylum. I don't know how you asylum, auxiliado. I don't know.
Asylum.
Asylum from my country. I cannot go back. So, you know, I have lost a lot of people that I care. My best friends that died. My cousin that I love died. I have lost a lot of relations with a lot of family members. So that's the real story, no? And that's not cool, you know. It's I'm not gonna say that you're not gonna get the boom. That's I have to tell them the truth. Yeah, I was a man, one of the main guys of this organization. But in the end, for 20 seconds of being the man, it's been 30 years of being, you know, and suffering the bad consequences of my bad actions.
Yeah, that's a good message for the young people. And this has been such a powerful interview. I mean, we could probably do parts 2 and parts 3, because there's so much more to get into. I know you've been very generous with your time right now. So I'm going to urge the viewers to, you know, get your book. There's so much more in the book, Son of the Cali Cartel. It's available worldwide on Amazon as an ebook, as a paperback, as an audio book. And it's just breathtaking. You know, it starts out with what happened with the assassination and just then gets into all the details of the cartel. But, you know, if we did do another part, I'd be fascinated to hear about your, you know, your prison stories, the 5 years in prison, what you went through the on the run for 4 years, the challenges there. There's just so much more to it, William.
Yeah, I believe the book is the story of when I surrender myself and, you know, do my time in prison, not in prison. It's not like the part when I, you know, my legal battle is in there, I believe. But like you say, there are a lot more stories. You know, being in a jail is very, you know, it's another adventure. So yeah, later on we can make another one and talk about that. Maybe talk about soccer, talk a lot of stuff that's missing.
Can people contact you or follow you on social media?
Yeah, my Instagram is William Rodriguez AB, and that's the main social media that I have, and I hope you follow me there and to see what I'm doing.
So all those links will be in the description box, and a huge thank you to Reese Dry as well. He is managing William, and Reese's links will be in the description box. So if you want to organize something with William, if you want to interview William, or you want to do an event, whatever it is, go down in the description box and please contact Reese Dry. So thanks for watching this interview. Let us know in the comments what you thought. Really appreciate it. Take care wherever you are in the world. And huge thank you to William for being so generous with his time. Cheers.
Thank you.